the operator on recording at this time. If anybody does have any objections, you may disconnect. And ma'am, you may begin when you're ready.
Okay, thank you very much. I'd like to welcome everybody to our first Charm Telecon of 2006. This is our first Charm Telecon, by the way, that's also not only is the guest speaker from overseas, he's joining us from Germany, but we have two of our Saturn Observation Campaign members are now international. We have somebody from Germany and Ireland joining us today. So the Charm Telecons have gone international. Today we have joining us Dr. Sascha Kempf. He's with the Cosmic Dust Analyzer, and he'll be telling us today about the first results from the dust detector on board Cassini. And we have 2 hours is the full time, but normally, Sascha, about 1 hour, feel free to take as much time as you'd like, but right around 1 hour would be good.
Yeah, that's my intention, too, since we have night right now in Germany.
Good point.
Go ahead.
Okay. So I'm quite happy that you offered me the opportunity to seduce you to the wonderful world of tiny dust grains. And actually, my group at Heidelberg had quite some experience in this, since we run the dust detectors, or we operate the dust detectors on the Galileo and Ulysses spacecraft. We had dust detectors on the Helios spacecraft and on Cassini as well. And we also provided assistance and participated in the dust experiments on Stardust, on Zeta, and on the Giotto mission. Okay, if we just proceed to the first slide. So this picture shows you the dust instrument before it was mounted on the spacecraft. This is so-called Cosmic Dust Analyzer. The instrument was designed and built in Germany, and part of the instruments were contributed by our colleagues in England. They did the mass analyzer, and we also carry a tiny sub-detector piggyback on the instrument. That's the high-rate detector. This instrument was built by a group at the University of Chicago. And the cosmic dust detector on the Cassini spacecraft is capable to measure the mass and the velocity of dust grains in quite an impressive mass range. So the tiniest particles we were capable to detect with the detector were order of a few nanometers, while the biggest particle the instrument can reliably detect is of the order of 50 microns to 100 microns even. And the dust and velocity determination is based on impact ionization. This principle, this basic detection principle, was inherited from the progenitors of this instrument on the Galileo and Ulysses spacecraft. But in contrast to this, to these detectors, the cosmic dust analyzer is also capable to determine at least roughly the chemical composition, the elemental composition of the dust particles by means of an integrated time-of-flight mass spectrometer. And that's actually the first time that a large sensitive area detector is capable to detect at least to give measures of the elemental composition of dust particles. And the instrument is also capable to determine, at least for the big particles, the charge the particles carry on. And this is achieved by means of a grid sensor in front of the instrument. So the grids are barely recognizable on the picture. However, the function principle is quite simple. The inner and the outermost grids are grounded, while the two inner inclined grids are attached to a charge amplifier. And as soon as the particle penetrated through the outermost grid, it starts to influence its charge onto the interior grids. And by means of that, we can measure directly the charge on the grain. You might ask, what is great about knowing the charge on the grain? The interesting thing is that if you know the potential of the particle, you can easily determine the mass of the particle. So this technique provides you with an independent mean of evaluating the particle mass. And besides this, we can also extract from the shape of the charge signal information about the impact angle and the velocity of the grains. So that's a quite novel technique, and with the cosmic dust analyzer, we actually demonstrated for the very first time that this detection principle works great for big dust particles. Okay, and the last capability I would like to mention is the high rate detector we piggyback on our instrument. The main detector, the so-called dust analyzer, is capable to detect one particle per second at maximum. Although this is sufficient for measurement in the interplanetary space, where we usually detect one particle per week of the order of that, in the inner core of the E-ring, the impact rate is much higher than that. So we detected up to 100 impacts per second in this environment. And in order to do this, we have the high rate detector piggyback. That's a foil detector, particles penetrating the permanently polarized foils are causing a short charge signal, and this charge signal can be counted or is counted by the detector, and so this detector provides impact rates for particles larger than approximately a micron, and this instrument provides very useful information when we are in the inner core of Saturn's E-ring. Okay, next slide. So now I would just like to explain a bit how we actually derive the mass and the speed of the dust grains. The problem is that the particles have quite large relative speeds with respect to the detector. So typical speeds are ranging between 5 kilometers per second up to 100 kilometers per second, and for screen particles, these speeds might be even larger. And this is quite a challenge to determine the properties of such a particle, and the way we estimate the particle mass and the speed is by means of the impact plasma produced by the particle when hitting the impact target, indicated by the yellow color. When a particle hits the impact target at this speed, the particle is transformed into a mixture of plasma, of impact plasma, and of tiny ejecta. And the plasma is separated within an electric field, and we are measuring or we are analyzing the evolution of the temporal evolution of the impact plasma on various electrodes. We have electrodes attached to the impact target where we collect the electrons, and we have charge-sensitive grids in front of the multiplier where we collect the ions, and half of the ions are capable to traverse through the ion grid, and those ions are collected at the multiplier and are finally forming the time-of-flight mass spectrum of the ions. Next slide. It might be, it seems to be easy to understand why the impact charge provides a measure of the impact mass, since the impact charge somehow relates to the number of atoms in the dust particle. It's difficult to understand how we actually derive the speed of the striking particle. And I would like to take advantage to explain this a bit, how this actually works. So the sketch shows the spherical impact target and the grain hitting the target. And we learned from that experiment that ejecta particles produced by the impact are moving with approximately the same speed than its parent particle. And since the angular distribution of the ejecta is identical for all dust impacts, we take advantage of the spherical target by the circumstance that the path length, the mean path length of an ejecta striking again the target is approximately identical for all impactors. And that means, since we know the path length of the ejector, this gives us a measure for the impact by analyzing the time it takes the plasma to rise. Since as long as ejector particles are hitting the impact target, new plasma constituents are produced and the plasma charge is rising. When the ejector stops to hit the target, the charge amplifiers are discharging again, and so the time it takes the charge amplifiers to rise to its maximum value is a measure for the speed. And if you know the speed, you can determine from the produced impact charge mass of the particle. And this is the basic principle of our speed determination. And we have an accelerator facility at Heidelberg, which allows us to study dust impacts or impacts by dust analogs in the speed range of 5 kilometers per second up to, let's say, 70 kilometers per second, and in the mass range between 100 nanometer to, let's say, 5 or 6 microns. And we perform thousands of impact experiments, and this provides us a basis for a quasi-empirical calibration of the rise time dependence and of the impact charge year dependence from the properties of the dust particle. The accuracy of the method is approximately a factor 1.6 for the impact speed and approximately a factor of 6 for the dust mass. This might seem quite huge, but you should keep in mind that dust particles cover a huge mass range and a huge speed range, and so for the statistical properties of the dust populations, such an instrument is really a very useful tool to learn basically everything what's interesting about such particles. Okay, next slide. This slide shows you how a transmitted signal actually looks like of a typical dust impact. That's an impact by an E-ring particle. The uppermost panel is the charge measured on the entrance grid system, and the second panel gives the charge measured on the small inner target where we collect the plasma electrons. The next panel gives the plasma electrons collected at the outer target, and the next channel gives the plasma ions collected on the ion grids. And apparently, all three signals have similar rise times, and the rise times, which is marked by the red color, gives us a measure of the impact speed, as mentioned. And in principle, all three signals provide an independent estimate for the impact speed and for the mass of the impacting particle. The lowermost panel shows the signal detected at the multiplier, and for particles hitting the inner target, we obtain an useful time-of-flight mass spectrum. For particles hitting the outermost target, the time-of-flight mass spectrum does not really correspond to the time-of-flight signal since the collimation of the ion started at the grid is too poor in order to do this. Okay, and yeah, that's it. And now I would like to talk about the major discovery we did by the dust instrument on the Cassini spacecraft, since we detected streams of dust particles emerging from the Saturnian system. And in order to explain to you why this is great and why this is interesting and stunning, I have to introduce you a bit to the history of the so-called stream particles. The next slide shows you a very old picture or a very old diagram. This diagram shows the impact rate as detected by the Ulysses spacecraft when Ulysses approached Jupiter in 92. And before this time, you know, impact rates by dust particles were quite boring, since the distribution of the dust particles in the interplanetary space is at least smooth. And I told you before that typical impact rates are of the order of one impact per week. Yeah, so being a dust scientist means that one needs to be very patient. However, when the spacecraft approached Jupiter, the colleagues detected quite something very different, and they observed impact bursts approaching or arriving from a collimated source, and they easily figured that the apparent location of the source on the sky was the position of Jupiter. And the even more stunning thing was, a point was, that the impact burst showed a clear periodicity, and the periodicity was of the order of 27 days and of 14 days. And this is a magic number in planetary science, since it reminds on the rotation period of the sun. However, it really took the colleagues a couple of years to understand what they actually observed. You have to understand that the dust instruments on the Ulysses and Galileo spacecraft did not transmit the impact signals itself to Earth, but they just transmitted some characteristics of the impact signals. And according to the characteristic of the impact signals, the colleagues thought that the mass of such particles is of the order of, or the size of such particles is of the order of microns, and this and the speed of the order of 20 kilometers per second, and this was very difficult to explain. Next slide. So the colleagues basically were faced by two major questions. What is the dust source within the Jovian system? So it was totally unclear. Although everything pointed for Jupiter, the source itself within the system was quite the... there were quite some arguments about this. And the other important question was, why are the dust streams outside the Jovian system system periodic? Okay, next slide. Finally, a couple of years after the discovery, a PhD student of Eberhard Grün found the proof that the particles actually, or that most of the particles were actually produced by Saturn's, by Jupiter's moon Io. This figure here shows you a plot, or a wonderful picture of this moon. And on the left side, you see a plume due to the sulfur volcanism on this moon. And this this volcanism is the source of the particles. And the acceleration mechanism is similar to the acceleration in a Betatron accelerator. When the particles were injected into Io's plasma torus, the particles get charged. And since Jupiter has quite a strong magnetic field, the particles start to interact with the Jovian magnetic field. And since Jupiter has a rotating magnetic or rotating dipole field, the particles experience an electrostatic force in their in the frame of rest, accelerating them outwards, provided the particles are positively charged. And as it turned out, by a later analysis by Eberhard Grün, Mihai Morani, and Gregor Morfu, as they figured out, the magnetosphere of Jupiter actually works as a huge mass spectrometer. Since only particles in a quite a narrow charge to mass range can escape from Jupiter's gravity. If the particles are too small, the particles tend to gyrate around the field lines of the dipole field, and the particles just get stuck to Jupiter's magnetic field. Why, when the particles are too large, they are not energetic enough to escape from Jupiter's gravity. And the fact that the system acts as a big time-of-flight mass spectrometer gave also hints about the mass of the particles. And to the surprise of the colleagues, it turned out that the particles need to be very, very tiny, of the order of perhaps 10 nanometers. And the particles also turned out to be very, very fast, of the order of 400 kilometers per second, what's approximately identical to the solar wind speed. In order to understand why the particles show outside the Jovian magnetosphere this pronounced periodicity, one needs to understand how the solar wind is structured. So on the next slide, I show a kind of a reasoning why the magnetic field in the interplanetary space has at least on average spiral-like appearance close to the ecliptic plane. The reason for that is that the solar wind, that's a thin energetic plasma, is moving radially outwards from the sun, and the conditions are such that the magnetic field lines are bound to the plasma volume elements moving radially outwards. And since the sun is rotating, the field lines finally just spiral up, and approximately at the Earth orbit, the angle between the field lines and the Earth orbit is of the order of 45 degrees, and approximately at the location of Jupiter, the field lines are basically parallel to the orbit of Jupiter. And this this spiral structure is the famous Parker spiral, and was quite impressively confirmed by measurements by spacecrafts on various missions. However, this is not the reason why the particles show this periodicity. The next important fact is that the rotation axis of the sun is tilted with respect to the ecliptic plane. And that means that, assuming a dipole field, for half of a rotation period, the field lines are piercing the ecliptic plane from the above to the below, while for the other half of the rotation period, it works the opposite. And so we end with a scenario that approximately half of the spiral is characterized by field lines pointing outwards, while the other half of the spiral is characterized by field lines pointing inwards. So the consequence of that is that the interplanetary magnetic field shows a pronounced sector structure. However, there's a case that is really the simple case. It's not always such that that we have to deal with two sectors. There are also periods when we have to deal with four sectors. And now, assuming a particle traveling with quite some speed, quite slowly, radially away from the sun, then then a detector on for magnetic field field space will show for half the rotation period a field pointing upwards, and for half of the period rotation period a field pointing down, and this is probably the reason for the periodic behavior of the dust streams. But before I will explain this a bit how this works, I just have to introduce two other facts. It's also an important property of solar wind that the speed of solar wind change is dependent on the processes on the surface of the sun. And so there are high-speed winds and low-speed winds. And if a high-speed wind moves into a low-speed wind, a shock front comes into being, and this finally resides into the formation of a so-called correlative rotating interaction region. That means that, as seen from the rotating sun, the shock front seems to be stationary. And the important thing about the so-called CIRs is that within the CIR, the solar wind plasma is strongly compressed. The solar wind speed is higher inside CIR, the shock region, and the magnetic field is enhanced. Okay, so what is the what has all this to do with the periodicity of the dust stream? First of all, the fact that we show a periodicity which reminds on the sector structure of the interplanetary magnetic fields immediately tells you that the charge to mass ratio ratio of the stream particles has to be quite large in order to allow them to interact strongly with the interplanetary magnetic field. And if this is the case, and we assume a dust particle moving away from Jupiter towards the Sun, this was approximately the configuration during the Ulysses approach to Jupiter. And for such a scenario, the B field for or the force due to the B field is leading to a force accelerating the particles upwards or downwards, and so we end up with dust trajectories oscillating around the ecliptic plane. And whenever this kind of warp dust stream is piercing through the ecliptic plane, the dust detector will see a stream, and a stream of dust particles. And this somehow roughly explains why the stream shows this periodic behavior. However, the explanation was not entirely satisfactory, since although one could explain the basic mechanism behind the formation of streams, people had difficulties to to explain why the streams are that short in time, why the duration of the streams was only 3 days and not, you know, modulated by a sinusoidal function. And simulations by Herb Zug and his colleagues finally demonstrated that only particles with speeds of 400 kilometers per second and size below 14 nanometer were capable to reach the dust detector for the configuration during the Ulysses approach. And for this simulation, he used the magnetic field data and the solar wind data by the spacecraft. And now it's actually we actually used the known properties of the big mass spectrometer Jupiter in order to calibrate the dust instrument for such tiny grains and for such fast grains, since the dust accelerator facility is not capable to accelerate particles of this size to this speed. Okay, next slide. However, perhaps 2 years ago or 3 years ago, Jupiter was assumed to be the only source of such streams, since due to its really strong magnetic field and due to its known volcanism, it just seems likely that Jupiter is the only candidate for streams. However, Mihail Rani took the risk to propose that Saturn might also be a source of stream particles, and we persuaded the Cassini project to allow us to scan for such particles. And we did this approximately half a year before Cassini started his tour around the planet itself. And the most favorable spacecraft configuration to detect stream particles or to detect any kind of collimated dust stream is to have the spacecraft perform a continuous roll, and this will finally lead or this allows us to scan with our quite large field of view through the streams and to determine the directionality of the streams reliably. And since Cassini is not that well designed, or the Cassini spacecraft is not capable to perform never-ending rolls for very long periods, we persuaded basically the project to allow us to have the spacecraft rolling for 30 days. And believe it or not, during the 30 days, we detected no stream particle at all. However, when the spacecraft then started to maintain a fixed attitude to allow to the other teams to do different kinds of investigations. We observed the first stream of such particles, and until Cassini entered its orbit around Saturn, we detected about 2,000 dust particles, stream particles, and the particles again showed a pronounced bursty behavior. We also observed impact bursts of the order of 3 days, and we also found that the intensity of the burst was increasing with decreasing distance to Saturn, and this all indicated strongly for Saturn being a source of stream particles as well. Next slide. Then we took advantage from the fact that we transmit the impact signals to Earth, and just by looking onto the impact features on the electron collecting target, we realized that the particles really were very, very fast. The first column shows a stream or particle we detected in the vicinity of Saturn, and the red arrows indicate the right time, and the right time is really, really short. The next column shows the feature of a stream particle escape from the Jovian system, and the right time is even a bit longer, and longer right times means slower particles, and the right column shows the fastest impact we ever observed in the laboratory, and the speed of this particle was of the order of 70 kilometers per second. And from that, we could immediately conclude that the speeds of the particles we observed in the when we approached Saturn was of the order of at least 100 kilometers per second. And when comparing with the thickness of the Jovian stream particles, it's even possible that the particle or the signal is still compatible with impact speed of 400 kilometers per second. And we could also conclude from the impact signals that the particle needs to be tiny, of the order of 20 nanometers or less. Okay, now we made use of the fact that our colleagues studied that extensively how stream particles are accelerated within the magnetosphere of a planet, and we applied their work to the conditions in the Saturnian system. The big difference between the Saturnian system and the Jovian system is that the dipole field of Saturn is stunningly well aligned with the rotation axis of the planet. And the field is weaker. However, the environment where the particles might acquire a positive charge by its interaction with the plasma sphere of the planet is larger than for Jupiter. And we learned from the analysis that there are two regions where particles might end up as stream particles. In this plot, the escape speed of the particle is shown as a color code. The abscissa gives the initial position of a particle which wants to become a stream particle, and the y-axis gives you the size or the radius of the particle. And since we learned from the impact signals that the particles detected were of the order of at least 100 kilometers per second fast, only the red colors are correspondent with possible candidates for stream particles. And this was quite a surprise, since one region where stream particle might originate from is beyond the orbit of the icy moon Dione. This is indicated by the blue box. However, particles starting at this environment, at this location within the Saturnian system, need to be really, really tiny, of the order of 2 nanometers, which is ridiculously small. And the other possible starting position of the stream particle are the outskirts of Saturn's A ring. And this is really quite a surprise, since, as you know, the A ring is composed of big boulders, of bigger boulders, of ice bodies, of icy bodies, and this environment is not accessible for in situ studies by spacecraft. And so, if the particles actually originated from the outskirts of the A ring, this provides us with a unique opportunity to study ring material from the main rings in detail. Okay, next slide. So, in order to figure whether the particles started at the orbital position of Dione or the particles actually originated from the outskirts, we did basically quite the same as Zug did for for the Jovian stream particles. We studied the motion of the particles in the interplanetary magnetic field towards Saturn, and the plots at the bottom of the slide shows you trajectories of particles of different size started at the location of one of the big stream particle impacts we detected when we approached Saturn. And apparently only the red and the black trajectory hit Saturn, and red corresponds with 10 nanometers and black corresponds with 28 nanometers in size, while the tiny particle, the 2 nanometer particle, never hit Saturn. And so the simulation excluded that at least the particles we detected at large distances from Saturn originated from Dione's orbit. Those particles actually started from the outskirts of Saturn's A ring. And this is quite a surprising result. Okay. So this just summarizes what I explained to you, that at least the particles we detected at large distances to the planet originated from Saturn's A ring, from the outskirts of the A ring, and this allows us to study the at least some ring material from the main rings by an in situ technique. In this sense, the stream particles, the Saturn stream particles, are really the messengers from the main ring. Okay, next slide. So this plot shows you the mass spectra we obtained from ring particles. The lowermost panel shows the typical mass spectrum of the Jovian stream particles we recorded when we did the Jupiter flyby. And as you can easily recognize, the mass spectra of such of Jovian stream particles are looking very different from the mass spectra above this this particular mass spectrum. And all of these mass spectra are mass spectra of Jovian stream particles. The mass spectrum of Jovian particle is dominated by sodium. And a PhD student of me showed recently that the best explanation for the composition of the Jovian stream particles is that those particles basically consist of sodium chloride, which allows to get some understanding about the processes going on in the volcanoes of Io. However, the stream particles produced by Saturn are looking very different from that. They always show a carbon feature, an oxygen feature, a weak sodium feature, which we could demonstrate is due to impurities on our impact target. It usually shows a silicon feature. This is quite interesting. And it also shows a rhodium feature. And rhodium, that's the target material of the impact, or that's the material of the impact target. So the rhodium line should show up in each mass spectrum. And by doing, just by co-adding the quite faint mass spectra of similar strength, we realized that There are also tiny traces of SiO2 and of perhaps of hydronium. This is the molecule formed, or that's the ion formed by water ice. So next slide. Then we realized from analyzing the mass spectrum more carefully by the co-addition technique that we could separate the thousands of mass spectra, we will call it, into four groups. There are four composition types. There's a silicatic type. This is a type which shows ions by silicon ions, SiO2 plus ions, and also ions formed of the target material in silicon. There's an alkali composition type. This type is characterized by showing lines of the alkali elements, sodium and potassium, and it can be shown that this is actually due to the impurities of on our targets. And we also found clear or sometimes perhaps 10% of the impact spectra show indication of H3O plus and O plus ions. And this might be due to the fact that the particles are covered by a thin ice mantle, but this might also be attributed to just water vapor condensed on our impact target due to the exhaust products of the main engine. However, the most important finding was actually that there is a line which can be attributed to a cluster ion formed of the target material rhodium and Si silicon and silicon atom or silicon ion. And it's very difficult to form a cluster ion consisting of rhodium and silicon. And we learned from lab experiments that we studied a huge range or quite impressive range of different mass dust analogues, and we learned from that the dominating species in a dust particle tends to form a cluster ion. And this cluster ion is therefore an indicator that for the most abundant species in the dust particle. And since we found the clear indication for the cluster ion formed of rhodium and silicon, we actually found indication that the particles, the stream particles, are basically made of a silicatic material. And that's really a big surprise, since the main rings of Saturn, as well as the faint rings of Saturn, are composed of ice particles. And when we started the tour, we studied the ice particles quite extensively, and they're basically all made of ice. And it's difficult to explain why the stream particles are composed of silicate. However, there are a few points which at least give some hints why this is the case. First of all, there is an indication that that there are silicatic impurities in the material of the main rings, since the main rings appear to be a bit colored. And assuming silicatic impurities is one of the explanations for the ring color. And we also found, when we started the tour, that also the ice particles composing Saturn's E-ring show tiny, faint traces of silicates. And so the best explanation we can offer right now is that that basically all ice particles have tiny impurities by silicatic material. Perhaps these cores are due to where the condensation seats for the formation of the ice particles, perhaps at the moon Enceladus, and the stream particles are just, the cores of the particles which did not succeeds to accrete a substantial ice mantle on it, all the particles were produced between collisions of the ice of parental bodies of the main wings, and in the course of the collision, such material was set free and get charged and were accelerated outwards and finally ended up as a stream particle. So we are still working on coming up with a really convincing explanation why the particles are composed of silicates, but our mass spectra only allow this conclusion. So next slide. We also learned quite a big deal about the stream directionality from the measurement. The data shown in this plot here are impact data we recorded after Cassini started his tour around the planet. And whenever we the spacecraft left the magnetosphere of the planet, we started to see stream particles. And the interesting finding was that outside the... So we observed bursts, and in between the bursts, impact bursts, we saw particles arriving from approximately Saturn's position, and the speed vector was approximately aligned with the wing plane of Saturn. This plot shows at the upper panel the angle between the instrument foresight and the wing plane, and the mid panel shows the angle between the instrument foresight and Saturn, and the lowermost panel shows the impact rate. And the gray structures are indicating the angular range scanned by the instrument. Basically, each of these gray bars corresponds with an 8-hour spacecraft roll, and during such a roll, spacecraft performs about one rotation during half an hour. And this allows us to determine the directionality of the streams, and the blue boxes indicate the directionality of the streams outside an impact burst, and as I told you, outside an impact burst, the directionality of the particles is parallel to the ring plane and pointing towards Saturn. However, whenever we observe the burst, the directionality of the particles changed rapidly by very large angles. And during a burst, the particles arrived from approximately 90 degrees above the ring plane, with respect to the ring plane. So the particles actually moved on a bent trajectory, and also the angle between the instrument foresight and Saturn changed quite significantly. And the interesting finding was that whenever we observed the burst, we also found that the spacecraft was traversing through an CIR, which I explained to you at the beginning of this talk. When the spacecraft is traversing an CIR, in co-rotating interaction region, the conditions, the plasma conditions, and the conditions within the solar wind change dramatically. So there's an increase in the impact speed, in the solar wind speed, there's an increase in the magnetic field strength, and there is an increase in the plasma density, and our best explanation is that whenever the spacecraft or the particle moves in such an environment, the particle is charged up to higher charges, the particle experiences a stronger force acting on the particle, since the relative speed of the particle to the solar wind gets larger, and so the increase of the speed of the particle actually leads to the impact burst. So it's not the number density of the particles which is increasing, it's the speed of the particles relative to the spacecraft that is increasing, and since the field strengths are larger inside the CIR, the particle trajectories are more bent, and this leads to the deviation from the from its original trajectory. So the measurements we did outside the magnetosphere after the Cassini started its tour basically answered the question, what is actually the mechanism behind the formation of dust streams? It's actually the interaction of the particles with CIRs. And this is quite consistent also with the measurements, the current measurements by the Ulysses spacecraft. Alberto Flandes from the University of Mexico City analyzed Ulysses data starting from 92, and he found also quite an impressive correlation between CIRs crossings and the duration of the burst and the directionality of the burst. Next slide. And here this plot shows the same finding again for a longer period. So this plot covers approximately 50 days. And the green color indicates crossings of or traverses of the CIR by the spacecraft. And the lowermost panel shows the field strength, which is the indicator for a CIR structure. And there's quite an reasonable correlation between the change of directionality and the traverses from CIR. And now we are capable to predict or to tell the magnetic or the MAPS people dealing with fields and particles when the spacecraft traverses through a solar wind stream. So we are actually quite a sensitive, or we turned out to be quite a sensitive detector for structures in the solar wind. However, so this next slide just summarize again what I tried to explain, that inside the Saturn's magnetosphere, a thin sheet of radially escaping grains is formed, and this this sheet is warped by the interaction with the solar wind, and whenever these particles are traversing through a solar wind stream, the particles experience a strong acceleration and finally forming an impact burst or an impact stream as seen by the dust instruments. Okay, but the next plot shows quite a stunning result. We found that it's not only the interaction with CIRs which are forming impact bursts. We also found that from time to time we saw an impact burst, but we didn't see a change in directionality of the grains. And it turned out that whenever this happened, the spacecraft was traversing through plasma, which was due to a coronal mass event, ejection event. And although we have no explanation why this leads to this behavior of the particles, we found quite a stunning coincidence between such events and the impact rate. And this is basically all I can tell you about stream particles, and we are really excited about what we will learn during the remaining 2 hours of the Cassini's tour, in particular since the spacecraft is now starting to move on slightly inclined orbits, and at the end of the tour we will move highly inclined orbits, which allows us to come up with basically a three-dimensional picture of the of stream particles emerging from the system, and this will allow us hopefully to give you in a couple of years the full picture of this interesting particle. I thank for your attention.
Okay, are there any questions?
I'd like to ask a question.
Go ahead.
Deirdre Callaghan here, SOC member in Ireland. My question is about the high rate detector.
Yeah.
And it's plated with gold, and it receives high velocity frequent impacts. So how does a soft metal like gold withstand all these impacts?
Oh, I haven't heard your question, so I...
Sorry?
I had a better connection. I haven't heard you.
Will I repeat the question?
Yeah.
Yeah. My question is about the high rate detector.
Yeah.
It's gold plated, and it receives high velocity frequent impacts. So how does a soft metal like gold withstand all these impacts?
Well, the material of the high-rate detector is not gold.
Not
the material
gold.
Of the high-rate detector is so-called PVDF. So the PVDF is an abbreviation for quite an complicated name of an organic material. And the particularity of this material is that it's a thin foil. One foil is 28 microns in thickness, and the other foil has about 6 microns in thickness. And at the back of the foils is a metal film in order to support the foil.
Mm-hmm.
And the property of this foil is as follows. The foil is permanently polarized. And when the particle punches a hole into this foil, temporarily depolarizes the material. And this depolarization leads to a change of the capacitance of the foil. And this change of the capacitance is measured or is detected by charge amplifiers attached to the foil. And this short burst or this short peak of the charge signal can be used to detect the impact. And they also made use of the fact that the amount of charge produced by the impactor is also at least roughly a function of the mass and the speed of the particle. It's basically the mass of the impact energy. And that's why the high-rate detector, the charge signal of the high-rate detector is attached to four charge-sensitive comparators. And we count the peaks within four charge ranges, and this allows us to come up at least with a rough picture of the impact rate as function of the particle mass. So, provided you know the impact speed of the particle, and that's quite often the case when you are in a planetary ring,
yeah.
Particles are moving on Keplerian orbits, and so you know at least. With an accuracy of about a factor 1.4, the speed of the particle, you get the measure for the impact for the charge, and by means of that you know the mass.
Thank you.
But this detector is only sensitive to big particles. Stream particles cannot be detected by such a detector. So
okay,
this
can
detector,
I ask you another question just
yep.
while I'm connected to you? Are there plans to compare the cosmic dust samples from the CDA with the samples from Stardust Comet Wild 2?
Yeah, of course, we are happy to be guided by our colleagues. The problem here is that the dust, the Stardust mission collects particles in the interplanetary space,
yeah.
and it will be quite a challenge to identify such particles within the aerogel, since they estimated about 30 to 40 particles of this origin. And they collected particles at a comet. And the cometary material is very different from the material we deal with in Saturnian system, since in Saturnian system, basically, all dust particles are made of water ice. And, of course, water ice particles, even if there were water ice particles in the vicinity of the comet, such particles won't survive in the aerogel. However, we learned from the analysis of such particles quite a lot how to interpret our cruise data. So we recorded 3-4 good mass spectra of interplanetary particles, and the mass spectra of such particles indicated for silicate material as well, and that's actually not a big surprise. And we are very happy that the return mission succeeded, and we will definitely learn from that.
Thank you.
But, I just, to be honest, yeah, the mass resolution of our mass spectrometer is about 50, so we cannot come up with an isotopic analysis of the particles. We just can characterize the principal type of the particle, whether it's a carbon particle, it's an organic particle, a silicate particle, or an ice particle. We cannot do much more.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, welcome.
Are there any other questions?
So, Sasha, what are you looking forward to in the next 2 years of the mission?
Well, of course, we hope that there are more close flybys at the icy moons. We got exciting results at the icy moons. We found that Enceladus has an ice volcanism ongoing on its surface, and so we have big interest to have as many close flybys at the icy moons as possible. And we also, our basic desire is to map the particle properties within the within Saturn's E-ring in order to understand the dynamics of such a planetary ring. Since the E-ring is the biggest planetary ring of the solar system, the E-ring is a good analog, by the way, for a debris disk around a young star. So what we learned from such measurements will be of quite some importance for our astronomer colleagues as well. And we also want to map the composition of the particle within the ring. And by means of that, we want to learn something about the transport processes within the ring. And as you perhaps already realize, all these goals by the CDA team are based on big data sets. It's based on statistical analysis, and so we hope that we will be able to collect data within, or as long as possible. The more data, the better, and this is what we actually hoping to achieve during the mission. And as I told you before, we are also quite eager to study the dust environment around the planet when we are at higher latitudes, since this is actually the first time that a spacecraft moves left the wing plane or the ecliptic plane around the planet and studies the conditions at high latitudes. And this will allow us to understand the stream particle phenomenon or even unexpected new phenomena much better.
I have a question, if I may ask, please.
Sure, go ahead.
This is Homer Cox. I'm in South Carolina, and sir, it's good to talk with you, speak with you. I spent some time in Heidelberg and also Darmstadt, beautiful country. I have a couple of questions, if I may ask. I was concerned about, you said the charge of the particles help determine the speed, and you've also talked about the composition. Does the charge of the particles help you also determine the composition?
You mean the impact charge we collect at the target?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, in principle, yes. What we actually do is to separate the impact plasma in a strong field. So in front of the inner target, there is a grid. So the distance between the grid and the target is approximately 3 millimeters. And there's a strong separating field. And by means of that, the ions acquire approximately the same starting speed or the same energy, and this allows us to do a time-of-flight mass analysis of the ions collected at the multiplier. And you are right, the likelihood to produce an ion from a species within the particle is not only a function of the abundance of this ion within the particle. It's also a function of the composition of the particle itself. It's a function of the speed of the impacting particle. And that's the big caveat about our measurements. It's not necessarily so that when a species does not show up in the mass spectrum, that the species is not there. However, if a species shows up in the mass spectrum, the species is in the particle. And for the analysis of the stream particles, we exploited the fact that there are cluster ions, and cluster ions are a good indicator for the abundance of such atoms in the particle. But besides that, the analysis of such a mass spectrum is really complicated. And all in situ mass spectrometer flown on spacecraft are suffering from this limitation, since it's turned out to be impossible to get rid of the Oh, no. The particles always have these huge relative speeds with respect to the spacecraft. So whatever you do, if you do an in situ analysis of a particle on a spacecraft, you either have to collect the particle in a collector as stardust bits, or you have to analyze the impact plasma. And that's what we do.
Yes, sir. Okay, thank you very much. The second question I had really is, I believe you mentioned that dust particles from Jupiter are moving toward the sun. I can understand that, but question I guess I'm having in my mind is the Earth's magnetosphere is preventing most of this from entering into the Earth and be collected here. But I was thinking about the International Space Station. It seems that would be a good location also to do some studies on the dust particles. But I'm so excited with the dust particles from Saturn and also very interested in the CME events having an effect on the dust particles at Saturn. Thank you very much, and I appreciate any help.
Yeah, just to comment to this, we started to see stream particles, Jovian stream particles, when we left the asteroid belt. And this was basically the case for all spacecraft which detected stream particles. Stream particles from Jupiter were now detected by Jupiter, Galileo, and Cassini. Right now, Ulysses is at very high latitudes, and when Ulysses approached Jupiter during the last year, it again detected stream particles at higher latitudes. But it's not very likely that such particles will actually be detected at the space station. So the distance is too large, and at this distance, probably the dynamics of the particles is already entirely randomized by the interaction with the interplanetary magnetic field. So there's actually no need to worry about such particles. So they can only be detected outside the asteroid belt.
I have a question.
Sure.
And also like to say I've very much enjoyed visiting University of Heidelberg and the Schloss as well. This is Pete Goldie from San Francisco. Can you tell when your detector is just chance upon a cometary stream of dust particles? There should be, I guess, a number of those attracted to the gravity of Saturn.
A former PhD student of my group just told me when he analyzed the cruise data of the Cassini detector that he probably found the indication that Cassini traversed through a cometary trail in 2003. However, we detected 14 particles between Jupiter and Saturn, and six of them are attributed, or probably attributed, to a cometary trail. And so this gives you a measure, it is, to detect such a phenomenon. And the problem with Saturn is that Saturn is actually the dustiest place in the solar system, perhaps except during the rush hour at LA. And there's that much dust that you really have difficulties to distinguish between particles from exterior sources moving inside the Saturnian system and the ring particles itself. So we detect right now of the order of thousands to 2,000 impacts per day. And so since there are that many particles, they basically arrive from any direction. And the only way to distinguish between the particles, various particle sources right now, is by means of their mass spectra. And up to now, we haven't found a good indication for a particle from the interplanetary space detected inside the Saturnian system. And this is entirely due to statistics. And this finding is still consistent with the estimates by Jeff Cassi and Estrada about the flux into the Saturnian system. However, there is a unique and exciting possibility to determine the flux of particles into the Saturnian system by studying the dust environment of icy moons. Since the icy moons are that big, they have a very large sensitive area for dust particles, and dust particles hitting the surface of such moons are producing more dust particles, which finally form a dust cloud around the moon, and by measuring the number density in the dust cloud to get an estimation of the external impact of flux. This is a quite interesting technique to determine this important number, since the colleagues which are interested into the age of the main rings, they want to know how much dust particles per century are moving into the Saturnian system and changing the composition. That means that change the composition of the main rings, and this gives them a handle to estimate the age of the rings.
Thank you.
Do we have any other questions?
Phil Evans in Palmdale.
Go ahead.
Yes, I'm just curious. Looking at the spectra in these stream particles, there's a couple fairly strong lines of rhodium.
Yeah.
Rhodium, at least looking at it from the Earth here, is a relatively rare metallic element. Is that something that we would expect to normally find that far into the solar system? And if not, is there an explanation?
We definitely expect rhodium to show up in our mass spectra, since the target, the impact target, is made of rhodium. And we showed this material carefully, since rhodium is not likely candidate for cosmic silicates, for cosmic particles, and rhodium has the and rhodium is an inert material, so rhodium does not tend to form the molecules with other with possible contaminants. We use this material for the impact target, and this gives us also the possibility to calibrate the mass scale of such impacts, since we know that rhodium needs to show up, and we know the mass of rhodium, and by means of that we can do perform a better calibration. Most of the other time-of-flight mass spectrometer flown on spacecraft use silver as an impact target. Silver is also a great material, since silver has the two isotopes with almost an identical abundance, which can also be used quite nicely for calibrating the mass spectra, but we chose rhodium, and that's why it shows up in all the mass spectra.
Well, thank you.
Are there any other questions? Okay, well, I'd like to thank you very much, Sasha, for joining us today. We know it's very late there in Germany, and we really appreciate you taking the time. We've learned a lot today, and hope to see you back here in a year or two when you can tell us about the rest of the exciting discoveries that CDA is making out at Saturn.
I'm happy to do this. Thank you very much for your attention.
And for the rest of everyone, we're sort of canvassing people to ask for their ideas for what talks they'd like to hear from the Charm Telecon in 2006. I'm trying to line up some talks on Titan's atmosphere. We've had a lot of work done on the project recently, trying to understand the variability of Titan's atmosphere, and that will probably be an interesting talk. I've lined up a UVIS occultation talk and a couple of rings talks, and I was wondering if people would be interested in a more detailed spacecraft talk. I know that we've talked a lot here about the science results from the mission, but I was thinking, you know, a year and a half into this, that maybe a very detailed spacecraft talk about the capabilities of the spacecraft, how we control the spacecraft, all the engineering subsystems. Would that be of interest to this group, or I'm just asking since I have a whole bunch of you on the line right now.
I think that'd be a great idea for the spacecraft.
Yes, I agree with that.
Okay.
Yeah, the theater here in Ireland.
Sounds good. And then are there any other ideas that people are interested in learning about? Another idea I was thinking of was following up with the Huygens probe folks a year after their mission.
Yes, that would be great. Yeah.
Okay.
Can we have perhaps a session on what are the ideas being thrown around for the extended tour?
Oh, an extended tour, yes. Because we're just starting to do that work now.
Hey, Trina?
Yeah.
Is Ed and I did also talk about the new reference trajectory, or is that the wrong audience for that?
It's probably a little too detailed, but, I mean, we can ask. I mean, right now, because of the difference in Titan's altitude, we're having to change the trajectory slightly. Is that a topic of interest to this group? I would not think so, but I think it would be more interesting for this group to talk to the Titan scientists who are working on understanding Titan's atmosphere.
Okay.
but if there's any comments from the group at large. Okay, any other ideas? We've basically stepped through most of the instruments. We have a few still to go. We need a really good VIMS talk, but I'm hoping to get that as part of a VIMS ring science talk. So we've basically hit all the instruments. Is there any other topic that people are sitting around wondering?
Will there be any more close flybys of Enceladus or anything interesting like that?
We do have another close flyby of Enceladus, but it happens later in the mission.
Yeah.
It happens in 2007.
Yeah.
We have certainly had a lot of interesting science results from the Enceladus flybys of last year, and I'm hoping to get an icy satellite talk or two in the works for this year. Also, Hyperion is very interesting.
Oh, sure it is, yeah. Definitely is, yeah.
I have a question if I may ask. This might not be interesting for a study, but I was looking at the Saturn's magnetosphere, and I noticed that the shape of the magnetopause is different from that of Earth. It has a pointed, almost an arrow shape toward the solar wind as compared to a rounded effect on the Earth magnetosphere, and I was just wondering, maybe I can find it on the Internet looking for it on one of the servers, but I just wonder if anyone's thought about that.
Trina, this is Marcia.
Marcia?
Yeah, hi.
Yes, please.
So I work on the magnetometer. I'm here at JPL. And yeah, there are people at Imperial College that are actually modeling the shape of Saturn's magnetopause and Valshock and doing comparisons with Earth. I don't know if that would be a full talk, but maybe you could get one of those people to discuss their results.
And we did have a nice mag talk in the middle of last year. We might be able to go back to that presentation and take a look to see if it was addressed.
Yeah, I think I probably gave it. I don't know. I mean, it's just a matter of time while we accumulate a number of Valshock and magnetopause crossings, and then people model that. And in general, Saturn's magnetosphere tends to be blunter than the Earth. But, and I think the new results are kind of upholding that finding. That finding was from earlier spacecraft, such as Voyager. But I think Cassini's pretty consistent with that. But we could get somebody, if people are interested in magnetospheric topics, we could get somebody from Imperial College.
Actually, we had somebody. I'm just drawing a blank on who it was.
Michelle.
It was one of the younger scientists.
Oh, it was. Okay.
Who was that?
I don't know. I didn't hear it.
Oh, gosh. It was... Boy, I'm starting to lose my mind. Are there any other topics that people are interested in? Because I'm trying to set up the whole year sort of up front.
Personally, I'd like to see another one on some of the spiral density waves of the rings. I forgot who did it 6 or 9 months ago, but I wish there was a little bit more on that, because I still can't really present that in my presentations based on what was shown there. So.
Okay. Yeah, we had Jeff Cuzzi gave a brief talk in the July, I think, telecon, because it was the one-year anniversary. I'm sure we'll have another one of those also, by the way. I'm sure we're setting up for July or June to have the two-year anniversary, sort of the summary of our second year in orbit, will be one of the talks that we'll arrange.
This is Richard Manning calling.
Mm-hmm.
My son Rob had a really interesting session with the Cassini spacecraft's computer system, and it might be interesting to figure out how he decided to enable all of these different experiments to happen within the computer system that that they devised for the Cassini. Sort of a how-to or how they did it type of discussion.
Oh, how they did it. Sort
yeah.
of a, you know, building the spacecraft, retrospective
mm-hmm.
kind of thing.
Yeah, especially when you consider all of the variety of experiments that they were trying to accomplish, and how do you fit all of those, not only physically but electronically and digitally, within the spacecraft itself.
Okay. Also, another talk that might be interesting is how do we operate the spacecraft day-to-day,
yeah.
sort of in a practical terms. What
sure.
do we do here at the laboratory and around the world with our scientists
mm-hmm.
to put together a sequence and get it up to the spacecraft?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
we'll add that. A day in the life of the Cassini spacecraft. We might make it a month because we do sequences on about a month basis. Okay. Any other ideas?
Yeah, Trina, this is. I'd like to know more about how the different outreach activities are working. What's been working? What's been not working very well? And how they all interplay and dovetail through one another.
Okay. We should certainly be able to do that. We have a lot of the outreach people that participate in the CHARM every month. Okay, well, if you have any other ideas, please send it to the charm_leads@cdsa.jpl.nasa.gov. And I don't know what the talk will be for February. I'm still trying to line up the first few talks of the year. But everybody have a terrific month, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much. Bye.
Bye. Thank you very much.